नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Nice to see friends coming together for New Year's in a mindful way rather than a heedless way. I think we all remember our teenage years when we tried to be desperately happy at New Year's and became desperately stupid. At least I used to do that. And now maybe we come together and consider past, future. Janus, the god of the two-headed god, looking to the back and looking forward. So the convention of time coming to us from Greek and Roman cultures. So it's an arbitrary date, 1st of January. Could be any day. But days of recollection in the busyness of life are very important, I think, because just the endless demands of society and family and monasteries kind of keep us busy and distracted. And so to have a time to stop, recollect. So we've had some really nice diligent guests staying with us here. This is a very, very healthy kind of thing to do. In Christian culture, you have the Sabbath day. In Islam, you pray five times a day. In Buddhism, we have the one pra, the Upasatha days. So there's these times that we set aside to consider the direction of our lives, whether we are staying true to the truths which we find important, valuable. So for us, as a Bhikkhu Samanera Sangha, we kind of contemplate our own our training. And we're very, the way the Bhikkhu Sangha is set up and the Samanera relationship to the Bhikkhus and to the laity, it's very much like a vehicle. We call it the Theravada vehicle. And in the beauty of it is that one gives up to it, if one uses it well, I think, one gives up to a form, a structure, a hierarchy, a set of rules, a set of principles, a set of moral precepts, a particular style of chanting and an unusual style of dress, which doesn't work quite well in Canada, and so on and so forth. And it's actually quite easy, actually, if one learns how to give up to it. And that was one of the first things that Lompo Sumedho, I know, instructed me, was he said, well, just sit in the vehicle called Theravada Buddhism as a bhikkhu and just watch what happens. Just watch what happens. Your like, your dislike, your preferences, your disagreements with other Sangha members, your fears. And so I might consider what is the equivalent for a layperson? What is the vehicle you travel in? I think, and the more clearly that vehicle is defined, the more easy it is to watch your mind, watch your inner world. The more complicated your vehicle, your social vehicle is, the more you're having to engage with all kind of social issues, deal with this and deal with that, change this, change that. And it's very hard to look at the reactions of the heart, very hard to look at the mind and get some kind of insight, gain some kind of insight. And so the clarity that the Bhikkhu Sangha was offered wasn't really offered to the laity because it's not possible. Lay life is so varied, so different. Each villager in the time of the Buddha was living in a different way, and the Buddha traveled through different cultures, even within India. So he offered just a kind of general guidelines of good living. And one of the things, you know, he said that if you have trusted friends, if you have friends who have a moral impeccability, if they're wise beings in your life and they approve and applaud of what you do, then that's a good thing to do. And if those same beings disapprove, would not and do not applaud and look down on what your behavior, then that would be good to listen to that. And so much of a good spiritual life is having the vehicle and having the friendships within the vehicle, having a partner, as it were, to travel this journey in a skillful way. And a good friend or a good partner or a good husband or a good wife is one who doesn't just encourage ego habits and preferences. It's one who has the stability and insight to reflect back things which would be unskillful if followed, and reflect back skillful things if they were followed. And this is called Kalyanamitta, isn't it? You know, a spiritual friend. A friend who you, when you talk to them, they don't just pamper your needs, but they actually either challenge you or ask you to reflect or ask you to think about. And this is different than a friendship which is just based on getting what you want. You know, it's much more profound. And bhikkhu life is like that. Kalyanamitta, our life is one where we try to reflect back with each other, for each other, our strengths and weaknesses. And this sometimes not, it's not so easy, because to be admonished or to be something indicated that the behavior is not correct, it can create quite a strong reaction of self-disparagement or defensiveness. And that kind of reaction, when people say things to you which is strong and egotistical or defensive, those are things to really listen to. You know, really listen when one can't hear things, one has difficulty hearing things, because it's only in when we get reflection back that I think we grow. When we live according to our own terms and our own in our own heads, as it were, and we get no external reflection, it's really hard to see our behavior. Very hard to see our behavior. I think being a hermit is probably the most difficult thing. And hermits can get very, very deluded, eccentric. So in this, as we finish 2014, begin 2015, you might just reflect back for yourself. What are the conflicts that you had? What are the difficulties you faced? And is there anything in that behavior which you need to ask for forgiveness for? That doesn't mean you have to phone everyone up tonight and say, "Gosh, I wish I hadn't said that to you." But rather, just in your own heart, what were the behaviors that's caused you a lot of grief or obsession, or things that you slipped into, or things that you did which were unfortunate and caused yourself suffering and caused others suffering, and that kept your mind preoccupied? This chant that we did that becomes disenchanted with sounds and disenchanted with mental states. When we're preoccupied with our mental states, that's not disenchantment, is it? And why do we get preoccupied with things? It's either greed, hatred, or delusion. So what were the things that really preoccupied your attention? Were there things which really preoccupied your attention? And then if there are things which are kind of lingering or such like, then try to bring up a sense of forgiveness of the other, forgiveness of yourself. And very important too, because sometimes one has done things to others which one really regrets, really, really regrets. And so you ask for forgiveness of others, but also you give forgiveness for yourself. And where forgiveness can move forward is if there's a real determination then to change and alter one's behavior towards that which is more wholesome and more skillful. Because whatever happened this past year, some of it has been skillful, some of it has been unskillful. There's things certainly that I can remember, you know, even not so long ago, to some of my fellow bhikkhus, which I said, and I think, "Oh gosh, why did I do that?" And there's a regret in the mind. remorse in the mind because I got caught in some kind of issue or some kind of emotion. And that memory then comes up, and that can really obsess the mind. And that's not disenchantment. It's not disenchantment. So I can reflect in two ways. I can ask for forgiveness, but also I can make a determination. Well, if I'm going to practice disenchantment with mind states, if I'm going to have a mind which isn't constantly preoccupied with emotions and issues and the whole sort of 9 yards of being being a human, marginally neurotic Westerner, what do I need to do in the future where there won't be this constant preoccupation? What kind of behaviors and activities will be skillful for me? What kind of determinations and intentions can I make to be careful around those issues? Much of it is around speech. You know, a lot of our regrets and remorse come up around speech. So to consider, wow, that area of my practice where I lose mindfulness, where my intentions come from places of unskill, places of righteous indignation or anger or jealousy or greed, hatred, delusion. And how can I be more skillful of the arising of those things? You can't prevent the arising of that. You know, I can't say to myself that on January 20th I'm not going to get angry. I can't say that. I can say it, but I don't know. Someone presses my buttons, I might get angry or indignant or whatever. But I can, as I practice in this way of present moment awareness and trying to understand myself, I can make more and more intentions to awaken to the mood of anger, to awaken to the mood of jealousy or righteous indignation, and not believe in it. And that's what disenchantment is. Disenchantment is non-obsession with, non-preoccupation with. It's able to say, I don't believe that, I'm not going there. That's destructive, that's harmful. And that's being a kalyana mitta to yourself. That's being a friend to yourself. That's being a wise friend to yourself. Saying to yourself that, you know, you're never going to get angry, or I'm a terrible person for getting angry, that's not being a kalyana mitta to yourself. That's just being heavy with yourself. Making no intentions, making no move forward to kind of be awakened to habits of unskillfulness is also not kalyana mitta, because there's no growth in that. There's no growth in that. There's simply the kind of habit of rationalization. So quite often we can rationalize behavior which is unkind or unfriendly or stupid or distracted or whatever, and just rationalize it as being okay. But then it still preoccupies our mind. So the basic question is, where is the unfreedom of consciousness? What kind of mind in your life, what kind of mind states in your life are always obsessing you, preoccupying you? And what would be the freedom from that? What would be the freedom? It wouldn't be getting rid of it, because getting rid of it is still obsessing with, it's still preoccupying. It would be being disenchanted with it. And disenchantment is different. Disenchantment is different. It's not denying the existence of sights, sounds, tastes, and all the rest of it, or mind states or emotions. It's becoming disenchanted with it. Because why? Because our interest in the spiritual life is not the repetition of our egos, our emotional lives. It's to discover something which is always here, but to discover something which is not just an emotional changing habit. And that is the peace of the mind. The peace of the mind is what opens to the mind which is disenchanted with sense consciousness. Now to be dismissive of sense consciousness, or to say it's bad or to say it's wrong, is still being enchanted with it. You know, like to just be judgmental about your negative emotions, it's really still wrapped up in them. But if you see like a negative emotion like jealousy, and you just no, I'm not interested in you anymore. You know, you've driven my life for so many years, I'm just not going there. That's disenchantment. Judgment is just another mind state. Another mind state. So the method of the Buddha is very much one of wisdom and compassion, wisdom and kindness, wisdom and openness. And wisdom is that in you which understands what disenchantment is. Wisdom is that which knows that Sight, sound, taste, bodily feeling is worth making a problem of. It's worth pursuing, it's worth following. That movement towards Nibbana, that movement towards the silence and peace of the mind, that movement towards non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, non-preoccupation, non-resistance, non-problem, not making a problem of the way things are. And so as we go into this new year, we have this kind of paradox where Ajahn Sumedho, like I remember Ajahn Sumedho used to always teach, he said, the past is a memory. Future is unknown. Now it's the knowing. It's the only thing you can know. It's the only thing you can know is the present moment. You can know, you can have memories of what happened this year to you. And you can have future projections of what you might do next year, but you can only know that in the present moment. And yet, we can make intentions in our life to help us prepare for the future. We can do that. We can make intentions in the present moment. I can do that. Well, how the future unfolds, I don't know. But if I make intentions which are wholesome, that prepares my mind for being more aware of, more mindful of. So the consequences, like this moment, what I'm experiencing in this moment now, end of 2014, is the result of what I did last year, and what I consumed, and what I talked about, and who I met, and what I read, and before that too. So I have the result now. This is the result. The feelings of today are the result of what I did last week and last year and so on. This is the result. And then next year, 2015, at this time, if we're still alive, we haven't burned the vihara down, then that'll be the result, won't it? It's simple enough. Not very complicated, simple enough. So what results would I like in the future? Well, I think we'd all like to be happy, right? I'd like to be healthy, doing my best. We have a new exercise machine. 45 minutes today. Felt great, right? But tomorrow I might break my back. And my neck, it's uncertain. So where can I find, what kind of intentions can I make? Well, I can make social intentions. I can make intentions about my social life, about what I consume, who I relate with, the kind of skillful speech I can develop. That's very important. That's very important. I can make intentions about my own body and my own mind, to take care of it, to honor it, to not just use it for work, or use it for pleasure, or just push it in ways which are unskillful, even in meditation. A lot of meditators suffer from bad knees because they just push their bodies, just push them, push them, push them through meditation. Very common. So to make the intention to be kind to the body, to take care of the body. This is a nature body. Nature body, oh, your old body, 67 years, knees have been going, you take care of the old thing. This is how an old man thinks. When you're younger, you just push this darn thing and do what you want with it. But it is a nature body, right? It responds to kindness. It responds to proper diet and so on and so forth. And that's a kind thing to do, isn't it? That's a kind thing to care for your body, to just be caught up in beautification of the body is not really kind. It's a kind of fear, isn't it? It's to kind of be obsessed with the beauty of the body or the structure of the body, but to actually care for this body, yeah? To wash it and clean it and feed it. And it's a lot of work, actually. I'd rather be a deva, I think. I'm here, they don't have bodies. But anyway, here you go, you got this thing. And those of you who are younger than 67 years, take care of your knees. Take care of your bodies. It's very, keep your yoga going. And these, like just doing yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong or exercise and so on, these can be acts of kindness, right? They can also be acts of obsession. I have to stay in shape, I have to lose weight, I don't look good. But that's not kind. It doesn't come from kindness. It comes from fear, it comes from all kinds of unskillful things. So to be a Kalyanamitta to your own body, it's easy, simple enough, right? Not to fill your body with junk, not to push your body for work in ways which is really unkind and inconsiderate. And so also kalyanamatta to your emotional states, right? Kind of, what kind of emotional information are you putting into your mind and heart? What kind of attitudes do you offer yourself in the morning? Offer yourself through the day? Do you offer attitudes of, may you be free from suffering, Dhamma? May you realize Nibbana? Or, I forgive you for being a bit foolish this morning? Or do you say, you blew it again? Or, you're not meditating enough? Or something like that. Or do you indulge it? Do you just use a rationalizing mind to indulge forms of greed, hatred, and delusion? We do that too. That's not kalyanamitta, isn't it? You think if I had a friend and they were caught up in being addicted to pornography or something on the internet, and I said to them, "Oh, that's really good for your mind. It'll really develop a lot of renunciation." No, it won't. It'll just make your mind obsessed with pornography. So what would a good friend is say, "Don't do that. Don't go there. It's not good. It's not healthy. It's not beautiful. It's not kind. It's not gentle. It's not compassionate." That'd be a kind thing to do, wouldn't it? Right? So the same way, the way we offer reflection for ourselves, the way, because we're all working on stuff, aren't we? You know, we're all trying to be better people, and we're trying to move towards a consciousness which is more free and less deluded. So offering ourselves that kind of kind but firm reflection that a kalyanamitta could offer you, that would be good, wouldn't it? So we differentiate between just the rationalizing mind, which excuses all behavior, the endlessly tyrannical, self-critical, judgmental mind, which can never, never find anything good about one. These are the kind of extremes of unfriendship to ourselves, so we say. And then kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is like the friendship with yourself, friendship with your own difficulties, friendship with your own failings, friendship with your own lack of whatever, right? And kind of becoming friends with one's own fears, becoming friends with one's own angers, and saying, what is this about? Why is this heart so uptight? Why is this heart not at ease? What's the problem here? And that's the way you can enter into the very difficult parts of being a human being. Human emotions are complicated. Our histories, our family histories, our cultural conditions are quite complicated things, and they oftentimes will confuse us or overwhelm us in ways which we don't want. I don't think any of us want to get overwhelmed by things, but it happens. And then, so what would be the attitude? Say, wow, look at that. I really lost the plot on that one. And then become friendly with that tendency to lose the plot. What is that about? What is it about my character that just can't be at ease? Or peaceful, or friendly, or kind, or what is it? And so that's like a kalyanamitta. It's not saying that you're wrong for that, but it's also not just running away from it, distracting and seeking compensations in ways to not face up to it, because we have to face up to our stuff. And this is a mature person, isn't it? It's a mature person who looks very carefully inwardly to how it all works. And these kinds of intentions, then, what they produce is they produce more mindfulness. More mindfulness. Because when we care for something, and what, you know, to really care for yourself is not indulgent. To really care for pain, to care for suffering, to care for the sense of lack that we might face, this makes us more mindful. More mindful. This takes a kind of patient mind, isn't it? Right? The impatient mind just wants to distract or blame and get out of there. But to the kind of mind that is willing to engage with difficulties, like when you have a really difficult knot, you know, if you're doing weaving or something, and all your warp gets all caught up. And I remember like trying to learn weaving, and I'd be trying to lay out these warp threads, and it's so complicated. And this become the spaghetti junction, I just throw it all away. It's so complicated. But again, a patient mind which can just look at a knot and slowly pick it open. Pick it open. Quite often that's the way our minds are, you know, the complexities of our confusions or whatever, they're not easy to understand. They overwhelm us. So but the attitude, the intention of kindness, kalyanamitta, towards the very problem. It takes honesty, first of all. One has to be honest. Now, this is something that I can't blame on anyone else. And that honesty is fundamental. If I think that my problems are the projections of my mind, then I'll never be free. I'll never be free. Because always there's some external thing which I can blame. But if I see that, yeah, the problems, that life is this way now, these people are this way now, the environment's this way now, body's this way now, what am I creating around that? You know, what is it that I'm creating or putting on top of it? That's that kind of satchabharani, or honesty, that we need. Now, honesty is not self-criticism. Honesty is saying, well, I'm waking up and being friendly with a very difficulty. And then if one's patient and watches day in and day out, see the reactions, there's a lot more mindfulness there. And with mindfulness, you see the arising of a condition. You see how some language or situation or sound triggers some fear, some anger, some pettiness, some childishness, some whatever. And you, as you see it arising, you see, that's an object. That's not me. That's not who I really am. And you see how it arises. You see the causal connection. You say, oh yeah. And then you see it stay for a while. And then you see it cease. And that's freedom. That's disenchantment. Not that you've gotten rid of it, but you've seen it as a condition in nature, natural, but you haven't attached to it, haven't made a problem out of it, haven't been obsessed with it, been just disenchanted with it. Disenchanted with it. And that takes that takes character, doesn't it? Think about it, like, it takes a certain kind of character to have that honesty, to have that patience, to have that kind of friendliness to the very, very problem, right? The endurance, just to stick with it, stick with it, stick with it. The intelligence to watch, how does this work? What is cause and effect? Right? That's intelligence, watching that. To stick it out and watch, and then making a determination, you know, making a determination to stay with the problem, because the problem will come up again and again and again and again, right? Doesn't end just by one investigation. And that kind of determination, no, I'm going to understand this. You lose the plot, no, I'm going to understand this, you know. That kind of reapplication of mind, energy, virya, all these different factors. And this defines a Buddhist character. This defines any spiritual character, I think. All those good qualities which we call the paramitas. Paramitas are character. And this you know, when we think about the new year, you know, the facetious jokes are always about making, what are they, New Year's resolutions about losing weight, and then you forget after a month. And this is the kind of stand-up comedians are always doing. But, you know, there is something about determination. There is something about, and we call it adhitana. There is something about that which sets up a kind of character, doesn't it, in the mind. You think about all of us who have worked hard in any way. You know, whether it's get a university degree or be at the embassy or build a monastery or cook a meal or whatever, that takes a kind of application of energy for a span of time. You have to apply and you have to just do it, do it, do it, do it, adhitana. So you have to kind of keep going. So when we talk about New Year's resolutions, what we'd say in Buddhism is, what is the character of determination, adhitana? How does the character of determination fit into your spiritual practice? What is that? What is that as a character trait, wholesome character trait? Where would it be unwholesome? Where would determination be unwholesome? Well, wouldn't it be egotistical, obsessive, competitive? You imagine your own way, right? But adhitana barami is always also conjoined with the other baramis that we have. So it's always conjoined with intelligence or wisdom. And as I was saying at lunchtime, I used to make a lot of determinations as a young monk, but they were always very willful, very goal-oriented, very much trying to get rid of negative states, probably competitive, I can't remember, showing off maybe, look at me, I can do this and that. And I would always hurt myself, always hurt myself. And as I was saying at lunchtime, I once made told Ajahn Sumedho, because I always make these determinations to Ajahn Sumedho, and he said, "Oh, here he goes again." And I once made the determination that I'm not going to make any more determinations. And he thought, "Ah, okay, he's got some wisdom now," and he still reminds me of that because I'd forgotten that. So determination can be unskillful and stupid, but there is something about it, isn't there? There's something about anyone who sticks with their difficulties. You might not couch it in like, I'm going to make this resolution about that. You might not couch it in such specific language, but what is it about our character that is willing to just stay with it, just stay with the problem, whatever it is, and understand it, and understand it. And it's character. So you have these beautiful paramitas that the Buddha talked about, which are the kind of underlying goodwill, metta, is a character trait, underlying goodwill to myself and others. Because I can certainly get annoyed and say unpleasant things to people, but it doesn't have to come from ill will. It just come from bad habit and exhaustion or just heedlessness. And that's excusable, isn't it? Someone just is overworked and they just kind of blast someone. You say, "Oh, well, give him a break, stay away from him, he'll cool off." But someone who is hateful, someone who has ill will towards someone else, that's not good. That's not good. And there's a difference. There's a difference between just the passion of being irritated and the deliberate thought that may this person receive harm for this year. That's ill will. That we cannot do. That we can prevent from doing. As our mind, if our mind goes, no, I'm not going there. Because that's deliberate, that's thought out, and that creates strong karma, strong intention. So my intention then is goodwill. May I be free from suffering, may you be free from suffering. And then understanding that aspect of kalyanamitta, goodwill towards one's own complexities and difficulties and limitations and flaws and the rest of it. Apply goodwill towards that because that's the only way I'll understand. I only understand something when I'm willing to let it come into my heart, into my mind, into my consciousness. Right? And if I already have judged it as being bad, wrong, not allowable, blah, 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 there's no way I can understand it because I've already pushed it away from consciousness, but it doesn't go away. It just pops up in another corner, doesn't it? So goodwill is the willingness to, all right, what's this feel like now? This whatever it is, this terrible emotion or this boring emotion, what's it really like to be this way now? That's goodwill, isn't it? That's goodwill. So you apply goodwill, determination, intelligence. How does it arise? Is it permanent? Is there a real self in it? Or is it just it's just an object of mind, intelligence, energy, honesty, truthfulness. So patience, all these character traits. So I'm just kind of thinking what would be useful to develop this year for me is just be a better character, develop character. I could say, well, I want to get first jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, I want to be Sotapatti, Anagami, Sakadagami, Arahant, and all that business, which is very kind of Theravada. The problem with that is it's usually conjoined with self-view. It's usually a conjoined with ego. So what is the difference between me saying, I'm going to try to be more determined and I'm going to become enlightened? What is the difference there? Well, I think you can look at something like ill will and goodwill. And you can know goodwill and you can know ill will. Right? You can look at that. You can know when you work out on the machine and you want to do an hour and you only do 10 minutes. You see, there's not much determination there today. You can see that, you can see that. But some kind of attainment, which a book says that you should get, and you have never seen it, and you are trying to get it, you can't know that. You can't know that. You can just have an idea. Someone tells you something, and then you believe in the idea. Or you have some memory of something, and then you chase that memory or you chase that idea, but actually you're not really aware of the present moment. Not aware of the present moment. So the way of liberation and all these paths that we talk about is the way of letting go. It's the way of abandonment, is a way of non-attachment. Always it's about letting go. Whether it's about deep samadhi or vipassana, whatever you want to call it, it's always about letting go. Letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. Whether you choose an object of meditation or you're watching the changing nature of consciousness. So the paramitas are things that you can see in yourself. You can reflect on a paramita. But you can't reflect on something, you can't really reflect on something which you have an opinion about. You have an opinion, sure. Or someone else tells you this is what it is, but you haven't seen it. And so what happens in that kind of searching is you start to search for an idea and you miss the present moment. You have someone tells you there is this attainment that you need to get, and you start to look for it, and you're no longer in the present moment, and you're in bhava tanha. You're searching for something which you think you should get. Who is it that's searching? Who is the self that's searching? I'm trying to get this thing which they tell I should get. And so you have sakkaya ditti, you have bhava tanha, and you have all the kind of delusion of becoming. Whereas the path of letting go, or being patient, being determined to stay in the present moment, being kind with the way things are, being intelligent to see rise and fall or whatever, that is something you can do in the present moment. And this is the real very important thing about time, is that time is a convention. It's just a convention. Past is a memory, future is unknown, now is the knowing. And it's in that present moment we say the Dhamma is akaliko. It's not a matter of time. Not a matter. It's not a matter of getting anything. It's staying in the present moment with the way things are. And that's hard to do. That's very hard to do. But if we begin to just get that insight, it's not about time, then that whole idea of chasing insights or chasing something, then we come back into the present moment and we ask, why can't I just stay in the present moment? What is it? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Craving, whatever. Whatever way you want to talk. And then you begin to see how difficult it is to be patient with unpleasant states of mind, how difficult it is to be with boredom, how difficult it is to be with fears and angers, because you don't want them, so you seek something else. And so the contemplative begins to surrender into the present moment, to be with the present moment in a profound way, in a really, really profound way. And that's not easy. That's not easy to do. And that's what the paramitas are trying to do. It's trying to give us the kind of foundation strengths that we can be in the present moment with difficult states of mind, rather than the running towards or away or distracting or whatever it might be. And so in that, you see the ego arising in various ways. And so like the death of the ego, the death of becoming, the end of becoming. Matt, like if you're sitting and meditating, you feel you want, like we're going to start to retreat soon, and you're sitting there, and we've been used to working, and you want to do something, we've been really active and doing something, and just to sit there and feel the feeling of wanting to do something and not doing anything, that's not easy. That's not. It's much easier to brush your teeth 10 times. This is what you end up doing, or dusting your room 40 times, or whatever, or going for walks or whatever, but to actually just watch unfulfilled desire. Now that's a challenge. Unfulfilled, not to deny, but just to watch the feeling of wanting to get something, or the feeling of whatever it is, and just to be there and sit with it and watch it is non-grasping, disenchantment. If we don't have the barmi for that, then of course we just follow our moods. And so, and interesting, on retreats, people can get very depressed. You kind of think, oh, great, a retreat. And then you leave them alone for for a month, and you pick up the pieces at the end of the month, because the mind just can't stay with it, can't stay with being the way things are. So it takes a lot of skill to come on a retreat, to do a long retreat. It's a lot of skill. It's not so easy. But if our aspiration is to awaken to the present moment, see the way things are, just know the way things are, and see what is it that I'm creating around that. What's the problem? Then we're on the path. Then we're on the path. The rest takes care of itself. Just take care of itself. So our social conventions that we have, monastic, lay, put boundaries on us. And we have limitations. There's limited things we can do. Our bodies are kind of a boundary. Right? Can't do what I want to do with it. Our minds are kind of boundaries. And within that, there's things you'd like to happen socially, physically, emotionally. But no, it's this way now. There's a boundary. You can't get what you want. Or you get what you don't want. Right? So what happens if you can't get what you want? What do? Do you get angry? Do you just, do you just pressure, you just distract? But what does it feel like to not get what you want? That's the first noble truth, second noble truth. And to bear with that rather than blame or run away or concentrate to get what you want, this is the feeling of not getting what I want, or this is the feeling of getting what I don't want. That's the contemplative mind. That's more difficult. Not hurting yourself. But within that, then you see if the baramis are there. When you have to face unfulfilled desire in the container that you live in the body that you live in a social situation you live in, when you have to face unfulfilled desire, that is the challenge where the baramis come in. If you're patient, you can bear with unfulfilled desire. If you're intelligent, you know, no, don't follow it, you know. If you're moral, if you have patience and determination, you can stick with it, so on and so forth. And then what happens is unfulfilled desire, because it is no longer allowed to just chase its endless objects, unfulfilled desire comes to an end. Not because you got what you wanted, but because you watched what you weren't getting. And when you can watch what you weren't getting and you allow craving to cease, that's nibbana. Nirodha, the end of suffering. It's very mature kind of thing to do. Whereas the immature mind is always just trying to get what it can, trying to get what you want, which is not wrong. It's not wrong, but to face up to these things, like so. So like difficult emotions have a lot of craving around them. Fear has a lot of craving around it. Don't want fear, but just to be with fear and just watch it and be patient with it is very uncomfortable. But if you're patient, intelligent, compassionate, kalyanamitta, you watch the fear, the craving comes up, you watch the fear, the craving comes up, you watch, the craving ends, the fear ends, and the heart is liberated from fear. Not because you ran away from fear, not because you blamed anyone for the fear, because you were disenchanted with it. And that disenchantment is a strength. You said, that's not it, I'm not going to react to that anymore. And as it ceases, you realize this peace and this happiness is a possibility which is not dependent on social situations, not dependent on the body. You know, it's independent. Well, that's a pretty heavy talk, isn't it? So, a Happy New Year, huh?